Hello, Martin. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Good to talk to you again, Nelson.
Ah, yeah. Good to see you again. So, I believe you are working on a new book at the moment. And maybe you want to reveal some secret.
Yeah, I'm working on a book called Who Invented Heavy Metal, and it's a very big book. It's coming in at about 120,000 words. I'm doing it in my timeline with quotes format that I've done the hair metal coffee table book on, and I've also done it, used that format for books on Ozzy Osbourne and Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was going to be a book that included some concepts from the new wave of British heavy metal and even some concepts from thrash, giving the idea of when is metal invented as opposed to heavy metal, with the message being that it depends on how old you are, your answer to this question. But it turned out that I had so much material and so many cool concepts to talk about that I literally am finishing the book at the end of 1971. So it's basically from the history of time since the horns of Jericho in 1250 AD or BC to the end of 1971, where I don't want to give too much away, but very important in answer of who invented heavy metal. Two events at the end of 71 that are important to that are Black Sabbath, Master of Reality, and Deep Purple. So there's this battle that goes on between Black Sabbath and Deep Purple somewhat, and let's just say it's sort of resolved by the end of 1971.
Right, sounds very interesting. But we will get back to that later. As you know, it's our first interview of this series, which would be about all of your books. And today we are going to talk about your collector guide book series. And to begin with, can you briefly describe your collector's guide book series?
Yeah, what happened was way back in 1993, I self-published my own book, or my first book. It was called Riff Kills Man, 25 Years of Recorded Hard Rock and Heavy Metal. Yes. And the idea is that there were all these bands, all these things I wanted to organize in my own head, all these bands with connections and players going here and there. So all I wanted to do with that book was review every heavy metal album I could get my hands on. And it had about 1,900 reviews, not that many. This is pre-internet, so it was a little trickier, you know, having a big collection at hand. It was mostly my own albums, but my second book was a published version of that called The Collector's Guide to Heavy Metal in 1997, and it was still, every record that I had, I could get my hands on all in one book, and it was about 3,500 reviews. Then what happened was I decided, okay, there's so many albums coming out all the time, and I'm finding out even about more old albums. The internet is happening. There's more access to all this stuff, more access to the information about bands. What I ended up doing with that series was splitting it into a book on the 70s, Volume 1, the 70s, Collector's Guide to Heavy Metal, Volume 1, the 70s. Yeah. I did a book in the 80s, then I did a book in the 80s, and then basically, because there are more albums every year all the time, for the 2000s, I had to co-write the book with a good buddy of mine and a great writer from Montreal, David Perry. Right. So I wrote the first three books, and the last one is a co-write with David Perry. And it's apparently, I think it has, if memory serves me correctly, it has over 500,000 words in it. It's a very long book.
Wow, yeah.
Book. And between those four books together, what I've written and reviews in other books and whatnot, this is something I want to get around to doing. But apparently I may have the world's record, Guinness World Record, if I go get it done. But apparently I might have written more record reviews than anybody in the history of mankind across any musical genres at around 7,900 interviews. Apparently that might be more interviews than anybody.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. The first book in this list is 20th Century Rock and Roll Heavy Metal, which was published in 2000. I think that. The first thing that everybody would see on each book is the front cover, obviously. And regarding this book, it looks a little old in design now.
Correct on that. Actually, that book, I forgot about that book. The only reason that one you're thinking is part of this series is because the name of the company was Collector's Guide. So they these things. And that book was a little rare book that's long out of print, pretty ugly looking cover on it, but the cover's all up and one on women in rock and one on
sight. Exactly. I was going to ask you about the, you know, I am a designer, so I care about this stuff.
Yeah.
As I said, it's a little bit old now, but it has a purple theme everywhere with two swords joined together, which I don't understand why, because it seems they destroyed each other. And the words heavy metal in purple and purple flame with a picture of Ozzy and Dimebag, I believe, isn't it?
Oh, boy, I don't even remember.
Okay.
Illustrations, aren't they? I'm not sure. But, you know, that was an interesting little book because what I wanted to do with that book, and it's very dated, even the text in it, but it literally is a book about these are the most influential bands in heavy metal, influenced other people. And, you know, even though it's a crappy little book and it's old and it's out of date, there's some pretty decent writing in it and pretty decent arguments made for why these bands are influential and why they've influenced so many other bands. But it doesn't really fit in the series. The series really is those four books across the decade.
Right, but what was the reason that you wrote this book? I mean, what exactly did you want to say?
Well, the publisher wanted to do a little series on different genres, and other books are just more or less straight on the genres, but I said, you know, I want to do this, I want to add a little bit of intellectual heft to it. I don't want to just write a short book on what is the genre of heavy metal, so I said, let me do it on the most influential heavy metal bands, and that was the idea. So they're nice little, I thought for the time pretty well-written essays on why these particular bands are influential bands.
Right. So now back again to the design stuff. Can you tell me how you decide about the design on the front cover of your books? I mean, is it you deciding or some people designing some stuff then suggested you, then you pick up one?
Yeah, almost in every case it's the publisher coming up with the design, but I self-publish a lot of books as well, and that's a collaboration between myself and my layout guy, Eduardo. And he's come up with some beauties. Like, I really love the Scorpions cover, and I really love the cover of the Ted Nugent book. But you know, some of them were more or less my design and not a great design. I mean, even on my first book, I put a painting on there that I did, which is really bizarre. So after that, though, it's more or less the publishers that come up with them. And some of them are really good, and some of them aren't so good. But, you know, in most cases, that's just completely left up to them.
May I ask a question now about that? You have a cover photo on your Facebook profile. It's painted by a pen, and it looks awesome. Seriously, I was looking into it today and said, "Oh wow, this is great!"
Yeah.
Who designed that?
What I did is I found a bunch of my old school books from high school. And that is basically a full page, 8.5 by 11 page of. You know, looking just like that, just a bunch of band logos and stuff. And you can tell by, if you look closely, there's nothing newer than I think about 1981 or 1982 there, and that's because that's when it was done.
Yeah, it was great. It was great indeed. Okay, back to Collector's Guidebook series. The second in this list is Southern Rock Review, which has a more exciting front cover design, and I believe the name explains almost everything. But would you like to talk about it and tell us what kind of knowledge you shared in this book?
Yeah, that book was pretty interesting. Again, I always forget considering it as a series because it really was the name of that company, publishing company, was Collector's Guide Publishing, and that's why these are in there. But that book was actually called Southern Rock Review, and it is more like the other ones in that it is just a book of, it's about 400 Southern Rock albums reviewed. Mm-hmm. And it was the same sort of thing where I was seeing all these connections between all these bands, and I wanted to just kind of organize it in something. No one's ever done a book of Southern Rock album reviews.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was kind of cool. I wanted to say my piece and say what I thought of this music and what I thought the great albums were. You know, writing these reviews books is, it's almost the same sort of motivation that makes a radio DJ love his job, which is the idea of just turning people on to music that you like and you know, teaching people about music you like and then celebrating that music that you like. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why I like writing these record review books.
Right. So well, I'm interested to know what have you learned from, you know, when you've been working on this book, especially what have you learned about the relationship between Southern rock music and heavy metal music?
Wow, well, the interesting thing is that Southern rock really has so much, what I learned, I suppose, was that Southern rock has a lot of country and blues in it.
Yes.
What I also learned is that Southern rock, you know, on average, has very little crossover with heavy metal. I mean, there's not too many very heavy albums in the Southern rock book. I mean, the heaviest bands out of Southern rock were probably, in order, Blackfoot, ZZ Top, who are from Texas, and then maybe Molly Hatchet. But Southern rock bands, on average, were not really all that into heavy rock. They weren't very heavy. Other interesting things I learned is that Southern rock, I always found it amusing that Southern rock bands went through the same thing that heavy metal bands went through and pop bands went through, in that in the 80s, they participated somewhat in the hair metal genre. So, you know, everybody from Molly Hatchet to 38 Special, not really Lynyrd Skynyrd to too much of an extent, but they really commercialized their sound somewhat in the 80s and tried to have radio hits. And then the other interesting thing I suppose I learned thinking about it now is that the heaviest bands in Southern rock now are probably bands like Lynyrd Skynyrd and Molly Hatchet, who are both heavier than they even were in the past.
Yeah.
And I actually like them more now. I mean, it's funny when I talk to fans, you know, real purists will say, oh, the greatest stuff ever made was the early Molly Hatchet and the early Lynyrd Skynyrd. It's like, well, you know what, dude? I actually get more pleasure out of the last six or seven Lynyrd Skynyrd and six and seven Molly Hatchet albums than I do even over the earlier stuff, which is so counter to the way I am being, you know, a child of the 70s, the late 70s being the magic music period for me. But I like the fact that basically Southern rock bands seem to even think more in a heavy way now than they did even in the 70s.
Right. I see. Okay, you already explained it, but the next four books seem to follow the first one, and the name The Collector's Guide to Heavy Metal Volume 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I believe it's good and very reasonable that you separated the bands and music in these decades, as we both know there are some different facts about each decade, such as the technology, market, and other things. So which of these decades do you feel was the best era for heavy metal music, and why?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. I would say for heavy metal music the way we know it, I think the golden period really was the 80s, where we had the new wave of British heavy metal, we had the birth of thrash, we had hair metal. I like a lot of those things, a lot of those albums. And, you know, almost every band from the 70s was still participating in the 80s and making pretty good albums. So in terms of heavy metal, I think that's probably the golden decade. 90s, we know that heavy metal was on kind of a low, and it was taken over by other kinds of rock. The 70s, you know...
We still have Painkiller from Priest, which I believe is one of the best in 90s, you know?
Yeah. So... It's true. The 90s also gave us Pantera and King's X and a lot of Metallica stuff. So, you know, all the bands, you know, Machine Head, there was Sepultura. All these bands are, you know, there's a lots and lots and lots of bands making music. And that's why that book is, I don't know, 3,000 reviews or something. I mean, there's still tons of metal. It's just that metal was on a little bit of a commercial low. To me, being a child of the 70s, I mean, I probably enjoy way more of the music. In fact, I do way more of the music out of the 70s book than I do from any of the other decades. But, you know, the definition of heavy metal is a lot looser going into, all those terms they used, heavy rock, underground rock, hard rock, classic rock. But to me, yeah, and the other thing I really like about the 70s book, that's the one I have the fondest, you know, memories and even attachment to, is because it is by far the most complete. I mean, there's very few albums missed in that book. Mm-hmm. That were pretty heavy in the 70s. So there's tons and tons and tons of rarities talked about in that book. And, you know, the completeness of it and the cool obscurity and the scholarly level of it probably is the reason why it's the best-selling out of all four of them.
Right. So what fact do you think was where the reason that 70s and 80s was they're better than today or 90s? I mean, was it because of it was less technology or marketing or what?
No, I don't think it had much to do with technology. I mean, you know, the popular story is somewhat that grunge took over from hair metal and sort of killed heavy metal, and there's some truth to that. But yes. You know, it's just new genres entered into it. I mean, there were always genres going in the 80s too, and you know, sometimes as metalheads we think too in our own world and forget that there were, you know, bands from all sorts of other genres selling a lot of records. But the fact of the matter is, just ignore that. The fact of the matter is that you know. The 80s, we remember the 80s as just tons and tons and tons of heavy metal bands and exciting things going around heavy metal all through that whole decade.
Yeah.
But in the 90s, we had, you know, alternative rock, hard alternative, industrial music. So there was a lot of stuff competing for our ears. But there was definitely that whole idea that heavy metal was seen as somewhat ridiculous because of the excesses of the hair metal generation, the ridiculousness, the sort of looking at the gratuitous kind of misogyny and materialism of the hair metal days.
Right.
It just put sort of a bad reputation on heavy metal for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I would like to talk about this case, especially later on our next interviews, but I believe there is something great about this world of words, which is every time we write something, there are some people who disagree with us, and I like it personally. So I like to know how you feel about this, and what do you do when someone tells you they don't agree about Dan X, for example, or even tells you that you are wrong about case X, for example. So,
yeah, it's funny. I mean, you write 7,900 record reviews, and that's all opinion. I mean, this is not like my book on Ted Nugent or Scorpions or Megadeth or my new Whitesnake book or whatever, or Max Webster, where, you know, there's a whole lot of the rock stars speaking and there's factual stuff. I mean, 7,900 record reviews is like almost wall-to-wall opinion. Mm-hmm. So you definitely get a lot of that. I've had tons and tons of dialogues and arguments and debates, mostly good-natured, about certain things like that. You know, it's and my opinions have changed a lot over time. So a lot of times I'll be sticking up for my opinions and saying I think I'm right. Other times I'll stick up to my opinions and say, you know what? The whole world thinks this. You're in the minority on this. I'm just reminding you that your view is very odd. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that's the case. But yeah, sometimes, you know, my opinion has totally changed, and I say to guys like, dude, I'm so embarrassed what I wrote about that band. I was so off base. It's turned out to be a classic and I love it now. I just thought it was stupid back then, you know, because a lot of these reviews, you know, were written now going back 20 years. So lots and lots has changed. You know, a lot of things have happened, changes in different genres. So it goes all ways, but usually it's a fun conversation. The thing that I find really odd is when something seems so obvious as an opinion.
Yeah.
And you get someone who thinks completely the other way. And that happens occasionally. You know, the odd one that happened, I mean, this is a very obscure example, but it just happened recently, so it reminded me. I think the Mogwai Chocolate Box album is an amazing, incredible masterpiece of a UFO album. It should have been called a UFO album. And I think the other Mogwai album, Way of the World, is a terrible album. And most people totally agree on that. And I had a guy come back to me the other day and say, that is a masterpiece, and the other one is kind of crappy. So sometimes you get these opinions where you go, I have no idea what's going on. This is almost disorienting. And it really makes you question the nature of opinion when there's such a massive gulf between them. And that thing comes to mind where you think, are we even listening to the same album here? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it seems that far apart, right? But generally, I mean, you can have a discussion with people and say, you know, that's it. That's interesting. You're in the minority, but it's an interesting, and I agree with what you're talking about. But other times you can say, you know, I know many times I'm completely in the minority. I think Stairway to Heaven's a crappy song. You know, and I have that argument with people all the time. So I know when I'm in the minority as well, and it's interesting and fun to defend those views as well.
Yeah, isn't it an amazing world?
Yeah.
All right. In the end, how was it working with Collector Guide Publishing, and how happy are you with what they have done for you?
Oh, those guys were great. It was a blast working with them. I mean, those are tricky, hard layout jobs to do. I mean, there's you know, hundreds of thousands of words there. No, they were great. And I'm still buddies with them. Rob Godwin over there, he's a legend. He's done so many cool things in his life, and he's such a deep music fan himself. So he's a buddy of mine. I like those guys. And, you know, the other neat thing about those guys is that those books all sold really well. I mean, they were good at their job. They were able to sell those books. Now, granted, part of that has to do with, I think, the changing times a little bit. I think book sales across the board are down because books are competing with so many other, you know, media platforms out there.
Yeah.
But I have no regrets. I mean, all those books sold really well. I was happy with what they did.
Right. Okay. Martin Popov, thank you so much for giving me your time. And
thank you for caring. This has been fun.